Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Chronic Fatigue and Burnout Recovery Podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit more about autoimmunity, but before I go into the episode, I just wanted to say thank you so much for all the wonderful feedback that I continue to receive about the podcast. I'm constantly receiving wonderful messages on my Instagram account, just saying how much the podcast is helping you. And it really does mean a lot to me, you know, when people say that the information is helpful, not only just because it's a nice little boost to my ego, but because there's a lot of time and energy that goes into producing the podcast and it comes at an expense in terms of editing costs. So I just wanted to say that I really appreciate you for letting me know. And I also appreciate everybody who's taken the time to leave a review on either iTunes or Spotify. The reviews help to improve the podcast rankings, and this means that other people who haven't found this information yet are much more likely to find it in the future. So if you haven't already left a review on iTunes or Spotify, I would really appreciate it if you could just take a moment before you listen to the episode to do that now. And then also before we dive into the episode, I've got a little bit of a restless cat rummaging around in the background. So there may be some meows or various cat-like noises going on. I might just have to pause mid-recording to go and attend to the needs of the cats, but hopefully it won't be too disruptive to the episode. So let me just take a breath. I have been chasing this cat around most of the morning, but let me just take a breath and say, why do a podcast on autoimmunity, and where does autoimmunity fall in the context of this bigger picture, which is the fatigue recovery picture? I'm not sure if you can hear the meowing cat in the background. He's got a little cardboard box which has little holes in it, and in the holes he's got these little worms which have little bells attached to them. And his favorite game is to stick his little paws into the holes in the cardboard box and rummage around and then take the worms out with a little bell on. So obviously there's lots of bell ringing. And then he'll bring the worms down the corridor to give me as a present, usually when he wants some attention. And there's also a lot of meowing that takes place at the same time that the worm rummaging is happening. And so he's just doing that now, despite the fact he's had loads of attention from me already this morning. And now he's sitting in the corridor, just looking at me in my office, recording this podcast, making me feel very guilty for the fact that I am now not paying him attention and I'm recording a podcast instead. This is a little bit of an insight into my life on a daily basis. It's hard work being a cat mum. Anyway, yeah, hopefully he's just going to sit there now and not make too much noise. But let's come back to the concept of autoimmunity. So when it comes to autoimmunity, the way that I like to think of this is a hole in your energy bucket. If there are autoimmune processes taking place in the body, this is representative of a dysregulated immune system. Very often we talk about the dysregulation of the nervous system, and we know that nervous system dysregulation can be a problem for health and for healing. And the same is true for dysregulation of the immune system. In the case of autoimmunity, we've got an immune system which is acting inappropriately. It's starting to create a response to things that it shouldn't be responding to, like our own organs and tissues in the body. And then if this inflammatory response or this immune response is constantly on, so to speak, that's going to take energy. And in my training in psychoneuroimmunology, we learned about this concept, which is called the selfish brain and the selfish immune system. The idea being that there's a hierarchy. And you may have heard me say on the podcast previously that professional chess players can burn through 6,000 calories a day just for the amount of energy it takes for them to use their brain to play a game or chess or a chess tournament, shall we say. And therefore, this gives insight to the fact that the brain is a very energetically demanding organ in the body. And it needs to consume a lot of the body's energy in order to function. Then we also have the metabolic system, which when it's active, particularly, for example, if you do exercise, it also becomes very energetically demanding. And the immune system, when it's at rest, it's not very energetically demanding. In fact, the amount of energy we need to sustain our immune system when it's not reacting to anything is in fact very low. But when the immune system needs to react, it will need to use a very, very large amount of energy. And in this case, it trumps the brain in terms of priority for the body, because it's no use having a good brain if the brain is then being attacked. So the immune system steps up, we withdraw energy from the brain, we withdraw energy from the metabolic system, and we prioritize energy towards the immune system so that we can deal with threats. And then an ideal scenario, the threat is resolved, and then we go back to a healthy way of being. And how this would show up symptomatically is that if we were to experience an infection, if you have the flu, for example, you get brain fog, you get fatigue, your muscles ache, you get breathless walking up a flight of stairs, you can't think straight, you have a headache, your mood feels very low. These are all the symptoms of having the flu. But they are also the symptoms of energy being prioritized towards the immune system and away from the brain and metabolic system. In an acute situation that's temporary, the immune system resolves the issue, and then we restore energy back to the brain and we restore energy back to the metabolic system, and then we feel good again. But in the case of chronic illness, there can be this inflammatory component which is switched on, and then it doesn't switch off. It isn't given the opportunity to complete. And therefore, there's not enough energy going to the brain, and there's not enough energy going to the metabolic system. And then we're constantly in this low-grade state of fatigue, low mood, poor brain energy, muscle aches, inefficient metabolic system. So in the context of what we're talking about today, autoimmunity, when the autoimmune processes are switched on, this could be one, not all, of the contributing factors towards taking energy away from the brain and towards taking energy away from the metabolic system. So sometimes when I'm working with one-to-one clients, they may come to me with a diagnosis of maybe CFS or ME, or sometimes CFS/ME. Or something else, perhaps. And they also have an autoimmune condition. And they're kind of seeing the two as separate. It's like, yes, I've got this autoimmune condition, but I've been diagnosed with CFS/ME. And they're not necessarily thinking of how they're supporting themselves with the CFS/ME in the context of autoimmunity. Another scenario might be that somebody is coming to me and they have an autoimmune condition, but they're just experiencing fatigue without a CFS/ME diagnosis. And they haven't necessarily considered the fact that the autoimmunity is one of the driving components of the fatigue. Or maybe they have, and that's exactly why they're coming to see me to work on the immune system to support their fatigue. And then there may be another case scenario where maybe somebody has fatigue, or they have some post-viral fatigue or long COVID, and no autoimmune diagnosis, because nobody has actually considered exploring that they could actually have some autoimmune condition. And so that autoimmune condition is just lingering in the background. No one's found it yet. And therefore, nobody's thinking of their case in the context of autoimmunity, because nobody has thought to explore their case in the context of autoimmunity. So these are the three different scenarios that I might see in clinical practice. Obviously, I also see people without any autoimmunity, and we don't need to consider it in the context of their case. And that's a completely different situation, which doesn't really apply to this podcast today. But this podcast today is much more for those people who have already a known autoimmune diagnosis of some sort. They have perhaps a family history of autoimmunity, but they haven't considered that they might also have some sort of autoimmunity lingering in the background. And that's a really nice segue into the next thing, which is to talk about the stages of autoimmunity, because there are three main stages that I'm evaluating for in practice. So when we're talking about the stages of autoimmunity, we can have silent autoimmunity, which is when there are antibodies present, but there are no symptoms. So for example, last year I ran a comprehensive thyroid panel on myself. My mum is on thyroid medication. She's never been diagnosed with an autoimmune thyroid condition. Nobody's ever tested her thyroid antibodies as far as I'm aware of. I did ask her, but she's been on the medication for about 40 years and she probably doesn't even remember if she did have her antibodies tested. So knowing that my mom is on thyroid medication and 90% of underactive thyroid is autoimmune, I ran my own thyroid antibodies last year. And I don't believe I have thyroid symptoms, but I did want to just know if this was a thing that I needed to be aware of. So I tested positive for thyroglobulin antibodies. My thyroid function was normal. And that was including T4 and T3. So that would kind of be an example of silent autoimmunity. There are antibodies to a specific tissue, but there's no symptoms. So silent autoimmunity, stage one. Then the next stage is reactive. So reactive autoimmunity is when somebody has antibodies. They're producing, they may be symptomatic, but there's not necessarily any tissue destruction yet. Now, the thyroid is just a really nice way to describe these different stages. So for example, I'm working with a client at the moment who has for a long time known that she's had thyroid antibodies. She's had a lot of symptoms of underactive thyroid, like fatigue, weight gain, a lot of edema, water retention, to name a few. But her thyroid has always been normal. And therefore, she's kind of like in the sticking point where, like, I know this is here. I know I'm symptomatic, but the doctors aren't going to medicate me because my thyroid markers are normal. They're going to wait until they cross the line of abnormal, then I can take medication. And at this point, when someone is reactive but not destructive, this is where we want to really intervene to prevent tissue destruction longer term. And this is where we want to consider the autoimmunity is less about having a thyroid problem, but more about understanding that this is an immune problem. This is an inflammatory issue. This is much more about improving the regulation of the immune system and creating an anti-inflammatory environment for the body than it is about treating the thyroid gland specifically. So reactive autoimmunity is a really great place where we can intervene. And obviously, if someone is silent, we can take preventative measures as well. So stage two is the reactive stage. And then stage three is the destructive stage. So this is where we actually start to see tissue destruction. In the case of the thyroid gland, when thyroid hormone, when TSH goes up, when TSH then becomes abnormal, then we can assume that there has been some destruction of the thyroid gland because it's no longer able to function optimally. And therefore, we have to produce more TSH to compensate. And when someone reaches the destructive stage, this is where we may need to step in with medical interventions. For example, take thyroid hormone to bring the TSH down into a stable range. But we also want to think that that's just step one. There is still an immune issue. There is still an inflammatory issue. And we need to think about how we support the autoimmunity even when TSH has been stabilized with medication. And obviously, I'm using a lot of thyroid-specific examples here. One of the reasons being is that thyroid autoimmunity is one of the most common autoimmune diseases. And we are seeing a lot of that in practice. But this is just a really nice way to bring the information to life. It may be different depending on the different stages involved. There's a few more things that I want you to know about autoimmunity as well, is because autoimmunity, although there are certain types of autoimmunity, for example, you can have systemic autoimmunity, or you can have organ-specific autoimmunity, like thyroid autoimmunity or Addison's disease, which attacks the adrenal glands, or you can have brain autoimmunity where you're producing antibodies to brain tissue. There are lots of different types of autoimmunity, which are organ specific. We may think of autoimmunity in the context of that specific disease. And I've used the thyroid, for example. So someone thinks, okay, I've got Hashimoto's. Thyroiditis. But in addition to that, we also want to think about once somebody develops one autoimmune condition, they are much more likely to develop another autoimmune condition because the autoimmune condition is an immune issue. It's an immune dysregulation issue that is just expressing itself in a particular organ. Because thyroid autoimmunity is commonly screened for, we often pick it up in the thyroid, but it could be in other tissues as well. It could also be in the brain. It could also be in the pancreas. It could also be in the adrenal glands. It could also be in the reproductive organs, in the heart, in the liver, in the gut, like in the context of celiac disease. So there's lots of different autoimmune conditions. And if you have one, you are more susceptible to developing another. And this is why just taking some medication for your thyroid gland is not the same as dealing with the underlying dysregulation of the immune system. And from a fatigue management perspective, that's what we want to deal with. But also knowing and understanding if there are other tissues which are also maybe in reactive or destructive autoimmunity can be helpful in terms of overall understanding of the case and case management. However, the strategies we take are probably still going to be the same. So where I would like to go in terms of the rest of this episode is talk about those immune management strategies. We've spoken now a little bit about understanding autoimmunity and how it can impact energy, the different stages of autoimmunity, and then just understanding that it's an immune dysregulation issue as well as an organ-specific issue, because depending on which organs the immune system is impacting, that will impact symptoms. But ultimately, what we want to do is we want to support the immune system. And so I'd like to then just go into how do we do that? How do we support the immune system? But before I do, the final thing I just want to touch on is understanding the prognosis of autoimmune cases. You know, some people can have an autoimmune condition. They can implement the things that I'll discuss today in the rest of this episode and get absolutely fantastic results. And some people can implement all the things and the prognosis is just not as successful. So when we're working with autoimmunity, it's worth doing consistently and to a very high standard all the things I'm going to talk through today, provided they're applicable to you, because not everything is applicable. But also understanding that there may be a certain amount of traction with some things and less with others, or no traction at all. Generally speaking, systemic autoimmunity is a lot more challenging to work with versus organ or tissue specific autoimmunity. So for example, some of the systemic autoimmune conditions would be things like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis or Sjogren's syndrome. So if there's systemic autoimmunity in the picture, we just have to understand that it can be a lot more challenging to work with. And I think it's really important for people to hear this. This is something I was very aware of when I first started working in this niche. So there's a lot of people out there promoting this idea of full recovery. And I don't want to take away the hope that recovery can be full, because it can be. But I think we also have to take some of the pressure off of ourselves when we consider our healing journeys, and consider it rather as improving quality of life step by step. And that's a much more reserved way of looking at it in the context of autoimmunity, is how do we improve the quality of life of the individual one step at a time? Like, from where you are now, what can we do to help you feel 10% better? And when you do that extra 10% and you've got that extra 10% more capacity, how do we get another 10%? What else can we refine to get the next 10%? And so on and so on. And so I think it's just, when you are in a state of complete despair because you feel absolutely awful and your whole world has fallen apart, to go from that very, very low place to this idea of full recovery is almost too much pressure for any nervous system to handle. And so a big part of healing, I believe, is just coming to terms with where you are now, getting over that denial stage of the grieving process, settling into your current situation. So finding a sense of stability where you are now, finding ways to enjoy your life where you are now, being able to connect with yourself and being able to connect with joy and being able to just connect with a sense of who you are in this moment here and now. And then once you're more anchored into yourself, that's a much more stable and powerful place from which you can move forward in your healing journey. And then it's just about getting those extra notches on the belt in terms of quality of life over time, and just being mindful and patient in the process. So let's talk about the management of autoimmunity. And if you've listened to some of my previous episodes, you would have heard me talk about the concept of stability. And here I would say that the exact same things that I say on this podcast all the time really do apply. Just because you have a complex and chronic illness doesn't necessarily always mean that the interventions that you need to take to support yourself need to be complex. They might be. And they might be further down the line once you've created the foundations and built the stability. But let's start with the basics. The basics are really those dietary and lifestyle foundations that I talk about so much on this podcast. From a lifestyle perspective, it's about stress management. Stress management is such a general term we often use in this kind of chronic illness space. We talk a lot about the nervous system and having a regulated nervous system. And that's ultimately what stress management means. It means that you have the capacity to deal with the stresses you have in your life. And you can go into fight, flight, and freeze, but you don't get stuck there. You have the capacity to come back more into the ventral vagal system and be regulated. And we do that through nervous system, working on the nervous system actively through somatic tools, but also we can actively take steps to reduce stress in our life as well. So we're also supporting ourselves with the things that we find resourcing and nourishing in our lives, and reducing the things that we don't, reducing, workloads or toxic relationships or whatever it might be. We're reducing stress where we can, but at the same time growing capacity to deal with the inevitable stress of life. We need to be sleeping. That's something else that's really important for our immune regulation. And you can listen to previous episodes that I've done on sleep and circadian rhythms, because that is going to be really important. When I did my psychoneuroimmunology training, one of the key points around sleep was that we all have a natural rhythm. Some people are night owls. Some people are morning larks. So I'm definitely a morning lark. Ideal wake-up time for me is usually any time between 4:30 and 5:30. And I need to go to bed any time between 8 and 9 in order to accommodate for that. And if I have a late night, so if, for example, I sleep later than 9, I will still wake up at the same time each morning, like 4:30 or 5. And usually the later I've gone to bed, the earlier I wake, because my system is even more kind of like hypervigilant. And so the message is really to stick to your rhythm. So when I stick to the rhythm of going to bed between 8 and 9, waking between 4:30 and 5, that's when I feel my best. And that works well for me in my life. Not always when you're trying to socialize, but for the most part, it works well for me. It's more challenging when somebody is an owl and they prefer to go to bed between 1 and 3, but then they need to be up at 7 o'clock for work or children or other responsibilities. So then if we're constantly going against our natural rhythm, we're constantly living in a state of jet lag, and that's very dysregulating for the immune system. So I think one of the key things on sleep is to identify, are you an owl? Are you a lark? Are you a hummingbird, which is the kind of middle, maybe like 10, 11 to 7, 8 waking time, you know, maybe somewhere in between that, and honor that rhythm and honor that rhythm consistently, because every time you're going to bed later than your natural rhythm, you're essentially jet lagging yourself for the next day, which is not good for your immune system. The other thing is exercise. Exercise is always tricky when it comes to chronic illness, because many people will experience post-exertional malaise. And I know that this is a sensitive topic to talk about, especially for people who are in the earlier stages of their journey, who have very, very small capacity. The idea of being able to exercise seems almost impossible. But we do need to move. We do need to move within our capacity, whether that is a few gentle movements or stretches in bed or walk around the block, or, you know, yoga, Pilates, Qigong, a longer walk, or hopefully over time, more capacity for other types of exercise. We all need to find a movement routine that works for us. And when we move and when we exercise in a way that is within our capacity, which isn't overwhelming the body with inflammation and oxidative stress, this actually has a regulating impact on the immune system, which is one of the reasons why we don't want to just lay in bed and hope to get better. When the time is right, building a sensible movement routine into our daily routine can be very supportive for immune regulation, very supportive for managing autoimmunity. And then the final piece is relationships and the lifestyle section, because relationships can be very supportive, very, very nourishing and resourcing for our systems. As human beings, we evolved in communities where we had support, where we had physical touch. As, you know, babies get, you know, cuddled and hugged, and they need that physical touch for their health and their development. And sometimes we forget that as adults, that we need touch, that we need people. We can't isolate ourselves. And chronic illness can be very, very isolating. On the flip side, toxic relationships can be destructive. If we're in families where there's a toxic parent, or maybe in an unhappy marriage, or there's toxic friendships, all of that can be very dysregulating for the immune system. And if these things are really tricky to change, especially when your energy is low, when you're unwell, when you don't have resources, maybe to leave an unhappy marriage or whatever it might be, but it can be a piece of the puzzle for many people. And so it's beyond the scope of this episode to go into the details on relationships, but just understanding that healthy relationships are so important and unhealthy relationships can be so destructive. And these are all factors that we want to consider as we consider this idea of managing autoimmunity. So those are some of the basics. Then you would have heard me talk many times about on this podcast about blood sugar. When your blood sugar spikes high, that can increase the dysregulation of the immune system, the inflammatory action of the immune system. So it goes without saying, whether you have autoimmunity or not, all of my clients, we work on blood sugar and we make sure their blood sugar is optimized. But then when we're looking at autoimmunity specifically from a dietary perspective, we want to be removing foods that are potentially pro-inflammatory or foods that are cross-reactive. What that means is that when foods are cross-reactive, for example, if somebody has a known immune reaction to gluten, there can be certain foods known as gluten cross-reactive foods, which when eaten can also look like gluten to the body. This means that somebody who is celiac could be eating gluten-free grains, but the body is still reacting as if they are eating gluten. And it's not only gluten-free grains, it can also be other foods, for example, like dairy. Eggs are another example. There's quite a few different foods that react with gluten. People with autoimmunity can also react to nightshades. So they can be found in tomatoes, peppers, aubergine, and white potato, for example. White potato is also a gluten cross-reactive. And lectins, which we can find in nuts and seeds and legumes. So that sounds like a whole bunch of stuff. And you're probably thinking, well, then what do I eat? So many of my clients with autoimmunity have found an autoimmune paleo diet helpful. Depending on their energy and motivation, I might start them with a paleo diet. So a paleo diet is basically animal meats, eggs, fish, vegetables, fruits, root vegetables, but not potatoes, nuts and seeds, avocado, olive oil, coconut products, no sugar, no grains. And that can work really, really well for a lot of people. Obviously, then within that, we need to have other constraints, like does this person need to be on a ketogenic paleo diet, or how is this person regulating their blood sugar on a paleo diet, or is there a need to remove FODMAPs and be on the paleo diet? So it can get really confusing if there's a lot of complexity in the case, but we will keep it simple just out of in the interest of this specific podcast. So a paleo diet is a really good starting point for a lot of people who have autoimmunity. And then if necessary, moving to an autoimmune paleo diet, which also excludes the nightshades and then lectins. So that might be excluding bell peppers, tomatoes, white potato, aubergine or eggplant, and then your nuts and seeds and legumes as well. Legumes are excluded on a paleo diet anyway, but the nuts and seeds wouldn't be unless you're doing the autoimmune version. And I will say some of my clients who have autoimmunity feel much better on the autoimmune paleo diet. Some of my clients who don't have autoimmunity still feel much better on the autoimmune paleo diet. So in this idea of just like giving anything a go, just to see if it gives you a little bit more traction, it can be a really helpful thing to at least try for a period of time. I have had clients also do some food sensitivity testing. And even when their food sensitivity tests have come up negative for things like nightshades or lectins or some of these gluten cross-reactive foods, they've still felt better excluding them. So that is something that is worth noting. Some people want to do the testing because they want to see if there's anything that they are definitely reacting to. Or, for example, some foods can also cross-react with tissue-specific antibodies. And if somebody's got testing positive for a certain antibody, we may want to see if they're also reacting to certain foods and then make sure they exclude those foods. But for the most part, many of my clients are happy to at least try the diet, save the money on testing, and then when they feel better, that's always a good sign. So I kind of do recommend further testing on a case-by-case basis, depending on the client's budget and also what they're kind of just up for trying on their own. Sometimes people can feel that these diets are quite restrictive, so they'd rather test and then know for sure what they need to exclude. But that said, even with negative test results, some people still feel better with these food exclusions. The final thing worth mentioning here is that sometimes an increase in sodium can also trigger autoimmune flares. And there's a lot of popularity now with taking electrolytes, and especially high sodium electrolytes, specifically for people on low carb ketogenic diet. However, in some cases, it's worth being aware that large amounts of sodium can flare autoimmunity. That's much more the case for those who don't need the sodium because they're a little bit more, have some POTS type symptoms, or their blood pressure is low, or there's some adrenal dysfunction. It's probably more for those who have normal blood pressure and who are taking large amounts of sodium. Maybe if there's some metabolic dysfunction there as well, like they're overweight, they have high body fat, that type of thing. And then food coloring can also be potentially an autoimmune trigger. Most of my clients are not having foods with food coloring in, because most of my clients are eating a whole foods, paleo diets. But worth mentioning there, for example, you're eating really well and then you go to a party and you have something that you don't usually eat, and this food coloring that could potentially cause a flare. So that is like some of the basic stuff. You know, as I said, even though there may be a complex chronic illness, we want to start with the basics. And the basics are really food, stress management, sleep, exercise, and healthy relationships, and within the food piece, blood sugar monitoring. So once we've got all of those things stable, consistent, working really well, then there are some other things that we want to consider. I'm always thinking about the gut and the barriers of the gut. So we often hear about leaky gut, and leaky gut can be an issue for people with immune issues and fatigue in general, because if the gut is leaky and there's bacterial overgrowth in the gut, bacteria can produce toxins known as endotoxins, which translocate into the bloodstream, and then we end up with a case of endotoxemia. And endotoxemia creates system-wide inflammation, which means it's going to amplify any inflammation that already exists. If you have an autoimmune condition, that could be amplified. If you've had a brain injury in the past, maybe you get brain symptoms, which are amplified. If there was a joint injury, or you had a fall or a broken leg, or, you know, some other type of physical injury in the past, that may be amplified as well. So we really want to make sure that we are addressing the barriers, the gut barrier, ensuring that the digestive health is up to the state that we want it to be in. There's no bacterial overgrowth. That can be another really important thing we want to do for autoimmunity. But we also want to consider the blood-brain barrier. If there are antibodies to neurological tissue, if the blood-brain barrier is intact, that prevents those antibodies from getting to the brain and attacking the brain. And we can also have certain cross-reactive foods, for example, like proteins and gluten, proteins and dairy, which can be cross-reactive to immunological tissue. So if there's a leaky blood-brain barrier and then we're eating gluten and dairy, then we're more likely to get neurological tissue destruction. And interesting fact is also TPO, thyroid peroxidase antibodies, they can cross-react with the cerebellum of the brain. So now you've got thyroid autoimmunity, you have a leaky blood-brain barrier because you went and drank too much alcohol, for example, and now the antibodies are cross-reacting with the neurological tissue and then impacting the brain. So by having a good and healthy blood-brain barrier, we keep antibodies out of the brain tissue and we can protect the brain. Often if there's an intestinal barrier issue, there can also be a blood-brain barrier issue. And this is where I might do further testing with clients, is maybe if I'm suspecting that there might be some intestinal barrier issues, we'll test for that. And then if we test for that, maybe we'll consider, depending on the case, also testing for the blood-brain barrier. But in addition, we want to think about the pulmonary barrier. So if there's any issues with the lungs or history of asthma, want to address that. And the nasopharynx, so if there's any sinus issues, maybe we also want to consider addressing that in the context of the case. Then we also want to address infections. Some infections can have cross-reactivity or molecular mimicry with certain organs. So what that means, for example, is let's use H. pylori, which is a bacterial infection of the stomach. if somebody has H. pylori, they may start to produce antibodies to H. pylori. But H. pylori also, it has molecular mimicry with the thyroid gland. So someone has a thyroid autoimmune condition, they also have H. pylori. And as long as that H. pylori infection is active, it can potentially be creating further destruction to the thyroid gland. And so there are many different viruses, bacteria, mold, parasites that can also impact the case of autoimmunity. It's another thing which is potentially impacting the autoimmune condition through molecular mimicry, or just impacting the overall inflammation in the body and the immune system as a whole. So in the case of autoimmune management, we want to see if there are ongoing viral infections, ongoing bacterial infections. Is there Lyme? Is there mold? Are there parasites? And then decide on a case-by-case basis what we do to deal with those. Exactly what we do and how we do it goes beyond the scope of this episode, but it's something that I'm screaming for as I'm thinking about each individual's case. And then the same goes for chemical or chemicals, shall I say. We've talked about this immune dysregulation where the immune system is attacking things that it shouldn't be, your own tissue. This is what we would call loss of tolerance. The immune system has lost tolerance to itself. It has become intolerant through its state of dysregulation. But we can also lose tolerance to foods. And this is where food sensitivities can be an issue perpetuating autoimmunity. And we can also lose tolerance to chemicals. And that means if we're starting to have immune responses to chemicals, this is another way that we can continue to perpetuate the autoimmunity. For example, BPA, bisphenol A, we can produce antibodies to BPA, and this can impact the thyroid autoimmunity. So in which case, we obviously can't change the immune reactions to BPA, but if you know that this is something going on, you can be very, very vigilant in terms of your BPA exposure. So this is something we can test for. Being honest, I never get this far with clients. There are so many different tests we can do. And usually with doing a lot of the things that I've discussed already, we get enough traction, we get enough progress. We don't need to go as far as testing for chemicals, but it's an option. The same can be true for heavy metals as well. And then there can also just be just issues with chemical overload and detoxification, and issues with the gut can also impact the biotransformation of chemicals. And then all of these things will impact the immune system and or just play a role in the immune dysregulation as a whole. So just because there could be so much to potentially cover in this episode, I won't go into detail of all the things, but just having this understanding that we want to consider the role of toxins in autoimmunity, whether there are immune reactions to toxins which are impacting the total picture, or there's just a toxic overload in general, which is impacting the total picture and the immune system as a whole. So we've talked about lifestyle, we've talked about dietary management, we've talked about the barriers, we've talked about ruling out and addressing infections, we've talked about managing chemical exposures and toxic load. And the final thing just to talk about is how do we improve the tolerance of the immune system? I've just introduced you to this topic, which is the immune system makes hundreds and thousands of decisions every single day. And it's constantly deciding, do I react to this? Do I not react to this? Do I react to this? Do I not react to this? What should I tolerate? What should I not tolerate? And when we're starting to see immune dysregulation, the immune system has lost tolerance. It's becoming overly reactive, often to things that it shouldn't be reacting to, like foods, chemicals, and your own tissue. So we want to use an approach which is designed to support the tolerance of the immune system. And this is a model which I learned from Dr. Datis Karazian, who I just think is just the most wonderful person and human brain. I have done a lot of studying under his care. He is just the man when it comes to understanding all of these concepts. But he has a model which is called the 3 Ds. And the 3 Ds stand for distinguish, downregulate, and diversify. And distinguish means helping the immune system to distinguish friend from foe, because when it's overreactive, when it's lost tolerance, it's not distinguishing. It's just firing out at things that it shouldn't be firing out at. The downregulate means to downregulate the inflammatory responses. And diversify means to diversify the microbiome, the bacteria in the gut, because when we have a more diverse microbiome, we are much better at making important decisions. So I'll go into each of these D's in a little bit more detail, the first being the distinguish. And ultimately, what we're trying to do in the distinguished D is we're supporting the regulatory T cells. The regulatory T cells, as the name suggests, are regulating for the immune system. And one of the most powerful things we can do for this immune regulation is by encouraging the production of butyrate, which is a short-chain fatty acid, which should be produced in the gut. If we have the right balance of gut bacteria, and if we have a healthy amount of plant-based fibers in the gut, we then ferment these fibers, or the bacteria ferments the fibers, we produce butyrate, and it is known as a postbiotic. When I'm running stool tests with clients, a lot of my clients are coming up with low butyrate production. And butyrate helps to dampen inflammation in the gut, but it can also be important for these regulatory T cells so that they can do the job properly. So what we're looking for here is we are looking for digestive health, a good balance of bacteria in the gut, but also a good balance of healthy fibers in the gut. And those particularly good for butyrate production would be things like flaxseed, hemp seed, psyllium husk, and chia seed. Obviously, if someone's following an autoimmune paleo diet, they can't have the seeds. So then I encourage them to do what we call a microbiome mashup or a veggie drink, which is quite a lot of work to do. So it's hard for me to recommend this, obviously, to people who are very fatigued. But basically, you go to the supermarket, you go to the farmer's market, and you just get a little bit of 20, 30, 40, even different types of veg. Could be different types of leaves, different types of herbs, all and any different types of vegetables. In a food processor, you basically would create a pulp of all of these different things mixed together. And then you can store the pulp in the freezer. So maybe just like a tablespoon or a couple of tablespoons portioned out into environmentally friendly containers or packages in your freezer. And then I recommend that each day the client would take their 20 or 40 different plant-based ingredient pulp, blend it up in a blender with a little bit of water, just a small amount. So you're not making like a whole glass. You're just making like a small shot or a third of a glass, and you just knock it back like it's medicine. But in doing so, you're getting exposure to 20 or 30 or 40, however many you decide to go for, different types of plants. And that can be very supportive for the diversity of bacteria in the microbiome and your butyrate production. It's a lot of work, but I do have clients that do this. And I also have clients who would just find it too much based on where they are in their journey, and they don't do it. But what we do also recommend is that they supplement with butyrate as a supplement. And then in addition to butyrate, the other things that can be very beneficial for supporting these regulatory T cells are vitamin D. So we always want to check vitamin D levels, glutathione, which we're often recommending to clients anyway, because it's such a great antioxidant, and exercise. exercise obviously has to be appropriate to the individual, but it is very supportive for the immune system because when done in the right dosage, it is supportive of these regulatory T cells, which support immune regulation. So that is the first D. So this is how we help the immune system distinguish better between friend and foe. The next D is diversify, which is diversifying the gut membrane or the gut bacteria, shall we say. And that's actually a lot of what I've just spoken about in terms of doing the microbiome mashup, but it's also being aware of the things that are negatively impacting the diversity of bacteria in the gut. And that could be medications. It could be antibiotic use. It could be the fact that you weren't breastfed as a child or you were a C-section baby, that you've been on oral contraception for a really long time. Maybe you have infections in the gut that need to be dealt with. Maybe your diet needs work still. It's still too low in fiber, too still high in sugar. And there can be also stress, nervous system dysregulation impacting the gut, sedentary lifestyle impacting the gut or excessive exercise impacting the gut, and environmental toxins as well. So we want to make sure that we are addressing all of these different things in terms of creating a diverse gut environment. What I would say here is, as somebody who has a terrible history of antibiotic use as a child, I was given so many antibiotics that it would probably today be considered medical negligence. I have a very tricky relationship with vegetables. Actually, eating too many vegetables is not good for my gut. So we do want to have a diversity of plants in the diet, but we don't want to have too much volume necessarily. So this is where doing that vegetable drink or the microbiome mashup can be very beneficial, because you're just having a small dose, but you are getting the diversity in your diet. So if you have a tricky gut like mine, that's something that would be highly recommended. And then the final D is the downregulate D. And a lot of the steps for downregulate we've kind of already covered in the discussion already, because it's removing trigger foods, chemicals, and pathogens that would potentially be more upregulating for the immune system. That's following the autoimmune paleo diet, that's reducing the chemical burden in your lifestyle and addressing any pathogens that could be present. But we can also support the body with anti-inflammatory foods or supplements. So omega-3 fatty acids are great, and plant-based antioxidants like curcumin, polyphenols can all be great. When we work on the gut barrier, that can be really supportive. We need vitamin D, which we've already discussed, but also vitamin A. So for a lot of my clients, I might recommend a vitamin A supplement, or if they're happy to eat liver on a regular basis, that's a fantastic source of vitamin A. And we also just need to make sure that we're digesting our food really well, because when we don't digest and break down food properly, then we have a lot of these undigested food proteins, which are in the gut, and they're much more likely, especially if the gut is leaky, to move into the bloodstream and then create issues with the immune system and molecular mimicry. So that means we want to be making sure that someone is chewing their food, they're eating in a parasympathetic state, they've got adequate digestive enzymes, or they're supplementing with them, they've got adequate stomach acid, or they're supplementing with stomach acid. Or, you know, if there's H. pylori, they've addressed the H. pylori, so the stomach acid production is adequate. So there's a lot of digestive health pieces in the autoimmune side of things, but remembering that the basics are the best place to start. So we want to have those lifestyle pieces in place. We want to have a stable system. We want to have blood sugar regulation. We want to make sure our diet is really good. We're moving appropriately. And then we can start to think in a little bit more detail about infections and barriers and digestive health and chemicals and some of those other pieces of the puzzle. So that has been quite a long episode today. Obviously, autoimmunity is such a massive topic. And really what I just wanted to, I think my biggest intention for creating this episode was just understanding that autoimmunity is part of the puzzle of fatigue, whether you have a diagnosis of autoimmunity Or if you have a family history of autoimmunity and you've never been diagnosed with autoimmunity, could still be something that is a factor in your case. So if that is the case, it might be that you want to consider some of the interventions I've spoken about today in terms of diet and lifestyle, food, the 3 Ds, which are fairly easy to implement, looking for infections, supporting barriers, considering toxic load. Or it might be the case of you actually do some testing and you start to explore if autoimmunity could be a problem for you. Is it a factor in your case? Especially if you do have a history of autoimmunity in your family. So this feels like a good place to wrap up. I hope you have enjoyed listening today, and I'll see you in the next episode.